accession number 10657, reel 25.
Right. Well, as we have said, there was no trace in the wadi, or no trace of anyone alive anywhere, of the men Lieutenant Douglas had seen, including the CO.
Was he ever found?
Yes, yes.
He found later, then?
Yes. Since taking command at Gazala, Colonel Jackson had led the battalion in the true sense of the word. He was a brave man, first-class leader, and after the battle, when burial parties went down to the Zigzag with Padre Nesbitt, that's N-E-S-B-I-T-T, they found Colonel Jackson and Alan Richardson in an area infested with mines. Unfortunately, some of the bodies had been booby-trapped, and a battalion stretcher-bearer was killed. It is almost certain that this would have been done by the Italians and not the Germans. No one ever knew whether Colonel Jackson and Richardson had died from their original wounds or had been hit again as they lay in the wadi. Right, well, meanwhile, my company in the area of the start line had taken up defensive positions on the left flank of the battalion front. The odd shell fell and there was a little bit of machine gun fire, but most of the fire was still being directed towards the wadi. However, one of my platoon commanders, Lieutenant Bill Bailey, was killed by a burst of machine gun fire. It was just bad luck, really, because it was obviously just a searching shoot and not aimed at any particular target. So before the battle even started, there's one platoon commander gone. Not long after the platoon runner had reported to B Company headquarters that Lieutenant Bailey had been killed, I spoke to Bill Douglas as he was being evacuated. He said that there was nothing on this earth that would ever make him rejoin the battalion if he should, once he'd recovered from his wounds, and that he would go in any conceivable direction so long as it wasn't in the direction of a TLI battalion. And we never saw him again. He had been wounded in the foot, actually, but he disappeared, and that was the last we saw of him.
Did you ever hear what had happened to him afterwards?
No, don't know what happened. We lost trace of anybody who left the battalion, really. Nobody ever followed that up, I don't think. So with the CO and the down in the wadi, it was really necessary to keep the momentum going, and I decided that, without being ordered to do so by anybody, that I would carry out the original plan, take B Company down, cross the Zigzag and reinforce A Company. We didn't have any mine detecting team with us, so I got the officers and NCOs together and told them that we would have to run the gauntlet and take a chance with the mines, both on the far side of the wadi and, if there were any, on the near side of the wadi. But the important thing to do was to get across without delay and reinforce A Company on the far side.
How did they take that news?
That they had to go through the minefield. Well, it wasn't the first time they'd been told they'd had to go through a minefield, you know. Similar things happened at Alamein and that. You just tell them that that's what we're going to do, and you don't have the sort of nonsense you sometimes get in American battalions or regiments when you have the company commanders arguing with the CO and telling him that it's a suicide mission and we're never going to make it, etc., etc. British troops are very sort of they take it it's as part of the whole scheme of things that somebody thinks it's necessary and therefore we've got to do it. I never remember any occasion at all when anybody was openly defiant of any order that was given. They might have grumbled about it afterwards. You know, you might hear them in the little group saying, oh, bloody hell, this is a bloody finish. This is always the same with this bloody battalion. We always get all a stick, all that sort of thing. But they were just getting it off their chest. And they still put up with it and did a good job. So I took the company down to the Wadi in single file, no flails, so therefore I didn't have to go down in threes. I led the company with my leading platoon commander, Doug Pinckney, who had only recently been posted to the battalion. I also had my company runner with me, one of the battalion intelligence section, and also some sappers. Rear company headquarters was back behind the 3rd platoon. I didn't know Doug Pinckney very well, but this is an example of the sort of thing that I only had knowledge of a few times during the war. But he said to me after I'd actually given my company orders, he said, I'm not going to make it tonight, I shan't come through. And I said, oh, don't be ridiculous. I said, you say that now, but you'll be all right. There's no reason why you shouldn't. He said, no. He said, there's absolutely no doubt in my own mind. He said, I'm not going to live throughout the night. You know, that's it. Absolutely. And he gave me some a letter or something, which I passed back down to company headquarters in case anything happened to him. But he definitely had a premonition that he wasn't going to make it.
Did you have cases of people having premonitions which didn't get fulfilled?
Well, no, I can't remember any other one except this that I actually knew about myself. Just this particular one. And I didn't hear of any others actually. I mean, this was just maybe there were other conversations like this between other officers in other companies and battalions, so you wouldn't necessarily know about them, you know. But by the time we got down to the Wadi, it was in fact fairly quiet, and the enemy gunfire had slackened a bit, and the leading section waded through the muddy water to the far side, and I knelt down to speak to Shepherd, who you will remember was the A Company platoon commander who had been wounded. He'd managed to scoop out a narrow trench with his hand, but as happened to so many other people in that wadi, he'd been wounded again and was in a pretty bad way. fortunately for me, I bent right down and put my head, my ear, right next to his mouth, because that's the only way I could hear what he was saying. I wanted to. He was giving me a little bit of information, or trying to, about which direction A Company had gone in. And as he hadn't said more than a few words before, there was Pinckney had actually trodden on a mine. Pinckney was behind me. And the shrapnel from the mine wounded me, bearing in mind that I was bending down and not standing upright, killed or wounded most of advanced company headquarters, and also set off an immediate fierce concentration of artillery and mortar fire. The machine guns opened up. The company second in command, Foster Gedge, was wounded. He had come up from the rear of the company when he heard the mine explode. which Pentley had set off, and he just crossed the wadi and was running up towards me when he was wounded, and my company sergeant major crawled out to try and drag him in to a little bit of cover under the lip of the wadi, but there was an absolute hail of machine gun fire, so Brannigan wasn't able to get through to him. But he then tried again. He reached Gedge, dragged him to safety, and then found that he'd already died of his wounds. So that's three of my officers already gone from B Company. And this left one officer, Jim Randall. And whilst Brannigan positioned the Bren guns, Randall crawled forward to me, and I told him to take what was left of B Company and to cross the anti-tank ditch and to join A Company in Wurtsey. Randall and the CSM took the company forward, left the wounded in the wadi, where there was very little cover, and there was then 10 minutes of intense gunfire, machine gun fire, which was enfilading the whole of the crossing place. The artillery and mortar fire was almost continuous. They had a 105mm gun, which you could hear the shells coming towards you like an express train. Nothing you could do about it, though. The wounded were spattered with stagnant mud and water. Some shells went down in the stream. Others fell on the banks where wounded were lying. And in fact, this particular gun did pretty terrible destruction. There were only a few people still left alive when the firing finished, including myself. Now, I don't have a very good memory of exactly what happened. It's all very vague, because I can recollect bending down and putting my ear next to Shepherd's mouth, and then the mine went up, and I don't remember very much else, although I apparently told Randall to take the company up to Wurtsey. What had happened was that I'd collected quite a few pieces of shrapnel, one which was actually sticking out of the back of my neck. It was about the size of a 50p piece, but it was embedded in my neck and immovable, in actual fact. And I'd also been, another piece had hit me behind my right ear. And what had happened was that I think that I'd been pretty badly concussed, because the next clear recollection I've got of anything is of Andrew Noble, the battalion medical officer, leaning over and talking to me at the regimental aid post, which was the other side of the wadi and 1,000 yards beyond the wadi.
So you must have been unconscious when you were evacuated.
I think so. And then soon after that, I was loaded into the back of an American Field Service ambulance for evacuation. But I don't remember really anything after the bang, but apparently I did quite a few things, as well as talk to, say something to Randall. I think I had a few words with Brannigan, but I don't remember any of it, so I'm a bit hazy about it. But what I did want to say was that the American drivers of these field service ambulances were absolutely fantastic. They brought their ambulances, their Dodge ambulances, right forward to the battalion headquarter area where the RAP was located. Now, this particular area had been pretty well registered by the enemy, and by day, with carriers, anti-tank guns parked there, it was a prime target for artillery and heavy mortars. It was continually under fire during the daylight hours. And there were numerous casualties, and really, unless you had to move, if you moved by day, you were in trouble. Movement was mostly by night. But in that area, Andrew Noble had got the RAP, was looking after the wounded, doing a marvellous job, and as I say, these ambulances were backing right up, opening their doors, loading in the stretchers and going off. They were terrific. When I was with A, B and C companies, by this time on their objectives, B company having reached the A company positions and more or less amalgamated with A company, Philip Hampson got his mortar carriers together and started to move down towards the Wadi, his intention being to get the 3-inch mortars over. The leading carrier with Hampson and Sergeant Mitchell went up on a mine. It was now about 4 a.m. in the morning, but still dark. And as soon as that happened, of course, it brought down another massive concentration of fire on the Wadi and where this carrier had gone up. And it was absolutely impossible. Hampson could see that he was never going to be able to get the carriers through the water anyway. And so he returned to battalion headquarters with the carriers. Quite a lot was going on in the anti-tank ditch at this particular time. Corporal Hart, who was attached to A Company, stretcher bearer, and his stretcher bearers were looking after the wounded in the anti-tank ditch. That is to say, those of all three companies who'd been wounded getting from the Wadi to the ditch. And a lot of men in the 8th Battalion owe their lives to Hart. In the early stages of the attack, when A Company had heavy casualties, Hart organised everything with his stretcher bearers, although several had been put out of action, and he cleared casualties not only from A Company but also from B and C, who had lost most of their stretcher bearers. He went out in the open under heavy fire to drag people in on several occasions. So that really became established as a sort of collecting point for wounded from the different battalions, the anti-tank ditch. That, in fact, is where Hugh Blackton, the second in command, ended up. Now, meanwhile, 505 Field Company and the battalion pioneers had started work on a crossing place to carry the weight of tanks and supporting arms in the Wadi. I think they used brushwood, sandbags and trees. But the machine gun fire that was coming down in the Wadi was so intense and accurate, was coming from the left of the bridgehead, that's to say the left of where A and B companies were. And also the mines on the banks of the Zigzag made it very difficult for them to work on the two banks. And what with that and the heavy fire coming down, they were not able to make any progress. By now, the Zigzag had become a veritable death trap. Nobody could move in it, or go down in it, to go across it, up the other side, or anything. It was completely enfiladed. And nothing, of course, could be done about the wounded who were still lying on the banks. The rifle companies spent the rest of the night digging in and consolidating, most of the digging in done by C Company. machine gun platoon of the Cheshires was allward forward to assist the rifle companies, and the Cheshires, bless them, manhandled their guns across the Wadi and the anti-tank ditch in the face of the harassing fire and took up positions near A Company in the Wurtsey area. But bearing in mind that it's now dark. First light on March 21st. Fairly quiet beyond the Zigzag, no counterattack imminent, but there was a hell of a problem in the Wadi. The sappers had laid brushwood for scenes as a base for causeways in face of the harassing fire, which was coming from the flank, and also They were still being bothered by the anti-personnel mines, and they had heavy casualties. But they persevered in the face of all this, and somehow or other, they got the causeway built. Three tanks of 50th RTR got across, but the third one smashed the fascines. No other vehicle, let alone a tank, could get across. That was that. It meant that the whole operation of what followed on our attack had got to be delayed. They couldn't get the remainder of the Valentines over. They couldn't get any carriers over. They couldn't get any anti-tank guns over for the 8th and the 9th. Neither could they get over the supporting battalion, the 6th, which had been waiting in reserve. And for the infantry beyond the Wadi, with no anti-tank gun support of any sort and only a few 68 grenades, it was a very critical situation.
Do you know why they sent the tanks over before anti-tank weapons or other supporting weapons?
Well, I mean, it's. I think if... Let me... All I was going to say was that I think had Colonel Jackson been in command of the battalion, remember it's in limbo to a certain extent now, second in command wounded, Bob Libwell not yet up with the battalion,
nobody in charge really,
the intelligence officer gone, I forget who the adjutant was, but he'd be the only one. But I think if Colonel Jackson had been there, he would have kicked up merry hell. And he'd have said, no, I want my two-pounders over at least, or my battalion anti-tank weapons over. And he would probably have insisted as well that the anti-tank battery with the six-pounders would have gone over, who were attached to us. It's such a crazy thing. Had they been Shermans or what... had they been Sherman tanks or Grants or something, you might have excused it. But to send Valentines over, knowing what was on the other side, I mean, they knew very well that there would be Mark IVs in that, which would outgun the Valentines, was crazy. As I say, I can only say that if Jake had been commanding, he would never have allowed that to happen. And I think it was a major strategy blunder, which could have resulted in those battalions being completely wiped out. That's a whole brigade.
They did come under very heavy pressure, didn't they?
The
battalions across the Wadi did come under extremely heavy...
Oh, yes. I mean, it was going on all the time, actually. But much worse than that is to come, in actual fact. But I think they were there for 3 days and four nights or something. But they were under pressure non-stop, 24 hours of the day, really, night and day. I think it says a hell of a lot for infantry who can hold their ground, knowing that they haven't got an anti-tank gun in sight, and knowing very well that there are only three tanks there and that they aren't much good. But they still carry on doing what they're told to do, as you will see later on from the sort of details of what went on. Anyway, by now we've got A and B companies amalgamated in Wurtsey, with only two officers, John Wheatley of A and Jimmy Randall from my company. Both A and B company had lost between a quarter and a third of their strength. They were down quite a lot. The enemy had started to infiltrate back by using the tunnels, and had also occupied three pillboxes that had been taken during the initial attack by A Company. Their snipers and some of their machine gun positions were actually within grenade range of A and B Companies. What happened was that the pillboxes were really untenable for our chaps but they couldn't allow the enemy to occupy them, and time and again the pillboxes were cleared. There were frequent sorties by A and B Company. Sniper and machine gun posts were knocked out, and they did extremely well and inflicted pretty heavy casualties on the enemy. A good example, I think, of first-class leadership from one particular sergeant and also the company sergeant major. The thing to do is you never sit back and do nothing. You try and keep the initiative all the time, and that's what they were doing.
Why couldn't they have occupied the pillboxes?
I think because the pillboxes could more easily be taken back from them than it had been for them to get them. But they were untenable to our troops. It could be that possibly the opening of one pillbox was on the enemy side or something, so that once you were in there, you couldn't come out. Something like that. But I mean, they only described as being untenable, and I can only think that those are some of the reasons. Also, possibly the layout of the trench system and the slit trenches and everything could have been more favourable to people creeping up on a pillbox or those pillboxes than it was on our side. Anyway, all these attacks, as I say, the pillboxes couldn't safely be occupied by A and B, but the enemy had to be kept out of them. And the sergeant's concern, there was a man named Crawford, W. Crawford, who did absolutely magnificent work, supported by a private Michael and a private Higginson, all of A Company. This little trio between them knocked off literally dozens of the enemy, from what we can make out. Now, on the other side of the battalion bridgehead, C Company were well established, but Ian English, not knowing what was going on down in the Wadi, was asking for a mortar OP and anti-tank guns. He knew nothing of the crisis in the Wadi. And later on that day, at about 2:30, there was a brigade HQ conference when it was announced that the 6th DLI would pass through the 8th DLI that night to deepen and widen the bridgehead. The sappers were to complete the causeways at night so that 50th RTR could cross and the supporting arms would follow. Now, that sounds very much like a brigade order, and probably would have been, because they would have ordered the tanks what and what not to do and the supporting arms. There's no mention here about Bob Libble arriving, so it's very unlikely that he was there at that time. Now, meanwhile, Italian infantry, about a battalion, was forming up on the C Company front, and Ian English saw this as a battery target. It started off as a battery target. He has the gunner OP with him, so it was called down by Peter Wakelin, who was the gunner. They then decided, back behind the Wegzau, to make it a regimental target, which brought in 36 guns. Again, we got a battery of 25-pounders falling short, but no casualties to C Company. By then, I would imagine that Ian has moved most of his company slightly left. Anyway, the guns completely smashed the attack. The infantry only advanced a short distance. They were caught in the open. Some surrendered. Some retreated. There were 250 prisoners taken. Bersaglieri. They'd been pretty shattered by the barrage of the night before. And they were rounded up by C Company, but mostly by the 9th Durhams, who took them back to their positions from where they should have been evacuated. C Company didn't fire a single shot. The complete attack was broken up because the gunner officer with C Company had been able to call down the gunfire in exactly the right place. In fact, if you had a good gunner OP, you were quids in.
How far away were the Italians when they were struck by this artillery? How far from C Company, so...
Not very far, about 700 or 800 yards, 1,000 yards maybe, something like that. But they were perfect for a 25-pounder shoot. It would have been for mortars, too, had they been there. As they got nearer, anyway. But they didn't fire a single shot. Now, of course, this was all good stuff for the troops, you know. Their morale was high. The rest of the day was fairly quiet. And there were no further counterattacks on the battalion front. Some of the prisoners carried back the C Company wounded. So they were used for that purpose, to carry them back, hopefully across the body without going up on a mine and up the other side. Now, that night, this is the night of March 21, the 6th DLI attacked, and supported by a heavy barrage as planned, and they now found themselves coming up against the Germans as well as the young fascists, and some pretty stiff fighting. A and B companies on the left flank were very busy in the early hours. The enemy carried